Numbers 26. Now, as we've been going through our study in Numbers, if you're new with us today, we've been working our way through the book of Numbers, and we've been following this nation of Israel. As God has brought them, of course, out of Egypt and had them go into the promised land. He had the promised land all reserved for them, ready to go, to come in, and God was going to be with them and take them in. But you remember that there was this generation that were unbelieving. They sent the spies in, the 12 spies, into the land of Canaan, into God's promised land. God had already said, I'm going to give it to you. But they were a little bit apprehensive. Well, we better check it out a little bit. We better just make sure that this is going to be okay for us. That we're going to be able to, you know, override the nations that are in there and all that kind of stuff. Well, they went and checked it out. And they got freaked out. They began to walk in fear and think, we cannot do this. These people are like giants. We're grasshoppers in their sight. We are not going to be able to come in and conquer the land and take the land as our possession as God said he would do. Well, it's just not going to work. And so there was a generation of unbelief. And God said, well, all right. If you guys don't want to go into the land, you got to spend a little bit more time here in the wilderness. It's never a fun time in the wilderness, is it? We've all been there. We've all been in those dry and barren times where maybe we've walked outside of God's will, or we just have not been walking in faith. Sometimes the Lord brings us through times of wilderness, even when things are going okay, and it's a time of just causing us to learn dependence and reliance upon him. Well, God was going to do that work in his people, but he was going to have them stay in the wilderness for 40 years, 1 year for every day that they were in the promised land spying it out. They were in there for 40 days, you recall. God said, I'm going to cause this generation of unbelief to die out, and I will bring your children into the land. And so last week we saw in chapter 25, this last big thing that kind of happened. Remember, it was through Balaam's counsel. We were talking about Balaam and the events that unfolded there from chapters 24 and 25, 23 as well. And so Israel fell into sin by partnering with the daughters of Moab and all that, fell into grave sin. And there was a big death toll that took place in that day. And I think it was God's way of just finally kind of wiping out those people that were of that unbelieving generation. He said, they're not going to inherit the land. And so now as we get into chapter 26, we are going to see now a second count taking place of the people of Israel. We saw this in chapter 2 of Numbers, the first census that took place, where God had Moses count the families and the tribes of Israel. Let's see how big this nation is for military might and just for the positioning around the tabernacle where each tribe was to be encamped. And so now we get into the second census, the second count, and that's kind of where we get the name Numbers for the book of Numbers, as we see these two main census counts taking place in the book. And so in chapter 26 now, we see again God moving Moses to count the nation once again. It's been said that God keeps count of his people because every person counts. I like that. And it can feel like that sometimes. We sort of get lost in the shuffle. We kind of feel like, oh man, God doesn't even, you know what's going on with me or doesn't care about me. No, God counts because every person counts and he cares for you. He knows the number of hairs on our head. Can you believe that? He finds it a little easier to count than others, but nevertheless, he knows the number of hairs on our head. Everyone's counted. And God cares about his people. And so we see the second count beginning to happen. Now, the census was taken for a couple reasons. Again, similar to the first, it was taken so that they would know their military might. And it was also taken so that they would be able to allocate the land. It was purposeful for land allocation when they would go into the promised land. Each tribe would get a portion of the land. And we'll see here that the larger tribes would get a larger portion of the land and such like that. And so it was purposeful for counting the people. Well, in chapter 26, verse 1, and it came to pass after the plague that the Lord spoke to Moses. Remember, it was that plague of the previous chapter, chapter 25, because of their sin. God just kind of wiping out those that he said were not going to come into the land. And now they're getting ready. We're going to count, and now we're getting very close to them moving in to the promised land. He says, take a census of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and above by their fathers' houses, all who are able to go to war in Israel. So Moses and Eleazar the priest spoke with them in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, take a census of the people from 20 years old and above, just as the Lord commanded Moses and the children of Israel who came out of the land of Egypt. Now Reuben was the firstborn of Israel. The children of Reuben were of Hanok, the family of the Hanokites, of Palu, the family of the Paluites, of Hezron, the family of the Hezronites, of Carmi, the family of the Carmites. These are the families of the Reubenites. Those who were numbered of them were 43,730. Move down to, let's keep reading, verse 8. And the son of Palu was Eliab. The sons of Eliab were Nemuel, Dathan, and Abiram. Now, another special note here about these two. This might ring a bell here. He goes on to say, these are the Dathan and Abiram, representatives of the congregation who contended against Moses and Aaron in the company of Korah when they contended against the Lord. Remember when Korah came against Moses and Aaron? Hey, you take too much upon yourselves. Why are you the leader? What about us? We're Levites too. We can do just as good a job as you. We're of the same family. You take too much for yourself, Moses. And there was a contention. There was jealousy and envy that took place. But remember what happened. God just kind of says, listen, I'm not going to stand for this. Moses and Aaron, they are my representatives. They are my people. They are placed in a position. Korah, Dathan, Abiram, you have your responsibilities. Why are you looking for more? Be faithful in what God has given to you to do. But they weren't. They wanted more, and they rebelled. And God wiped them out. And so it's kind of put here as a reminder, listen, as you guys get ready to come into the promised land, just be faithful in what God has called you to do. Be faithful in the responsibilities and the tasks that God has for you. Don't be, because it's kind of a human tendency to always look to maybe that position that might get a little more recognition. Maybe it gets a little more praise. Ooh, I would like that. I would like to be in that. Why is that guy in that position? Look at me slaving here in the back. Nobody even says thank you to me. I'm doing all this work. Why? I should be in that position. And we can begin quickly to kind of rise up with jealousy and envy and bitterness. That's not what God wants. That's not the heart of a Christian. God says, surely it's not the heart of my people here. And he squashed it quickly, nipped it in the bud. And he's reminding us right now, listen, when you're getting ready to come into the promised land, we are not going to have any of these issues. We should not have any of these issues. I'm going to remind you of their fate so that you don't fall prey to that and follow in their error or mistakes any longer. And goes on to say, and this is what happened to him. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when that company died, when the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a sign. So again, it became a sign for us. Nevertheless, the children of Korah did not die. Boy, I'm so thankful that the Lord didn't just kind of punish the whole family. You know, the sons of Korah weren't just walking around going, well, we're cursed now because our father did this. Well, I'm a really wicked person, but I can't control that because my father was that way. It just passed down generation. No. You know, the sons of Korah went on to become great worship leaders. Some of the Psalms that we read are Psalms of the sons of Korah. God blessed them and used them. Well, the sons of Simeon now, according to their families, were of Nemuel, the family of the Nemuelites, of Jamin, the family of the Jaminites, of Jachin, the family of the Jachinites, of Zerah, the family of the Zerahites, of Shaul, the family of Shauls. Now, these are the families of the Simeonites, 22,200. Now we're not going to read through this whole chapter because it's just a lot of names that, you know, it's a lot of work to pronounce their names. That's what I'm trying to say. And we're just going to skip through this here, okay? But now look at verse 18. The families of the sons of Gad, according to those who are numbered to them, 40,500. The families of Judah in verse 22. They numbered 26,500. The families of Issachar, according to those who were numbered of them, 64,300. Families of the Zebulunites in verse 27, they were 60,500. And then on to Manasseh in verse 34. These are the families of Manasseh. They were 52,700. And the family of Ephraim in verse 37, they were 32,500. These are the sons, Joseph, according to their families, sons of Joseph. Remember, Manasseh and Ephraim were the children of Joseph that Jacob said, I'm going to take these as mine. And so there was that break in the tribe, and Manasseh and Ephraim became two separate tribes, extensions of Joseph. And then we see the families of Benjamin in verse 41. They were 45,600. And the families of Dan, 64,400. The families of Asher, verse 47, 53,400. And in verse 50, the family of Naphtali. And they were 45,400. Now, read verse 51 with me. These are those who were numbered of the children of Israel, 601,740. Now, this is interesting. The second census, their count of the entire nation, 20 years old and above, was 601,730. Now, the first census, when you go back to the beginning of Numbers, you see that the first census was 603,550. In other words, there was a decrease of 1,820. So the nation, over 40 years, dropped in number. I find that very interesting. You see, what was happening to them? What was happening with them? They were wandering through the wilderness. They were walking in unbelief. In other words, they weren't being fruitful. They weren't growing. They weren't progressing. And you see, that's what a walk in the wilderness is going to do. When we stop listening to the Lord, when we stop responding in faith to the Lord, when we stop walking in belief, we are going to be those that will dry up. We will be those that become very unfruitful. We're not going to grow. God wants us to be those that, again, are walking by faith, not by sight, where we're trusting in Him and just going forward in progression as we are trusting in Him, depending upon Him, relying in Him, and moving forward. Though we don't always know what lies ahead, we go, Lord, wherever you have me to go, I'm going to follow in obedience. Though I don't know exactly what lies ahead, God, you're with me. And I'm going to go. And when we begin to walk by faith, we will be those that are not only walking by faith, but we'll be those that are bearing fruit, growing in Him. And yet we see here with these people, it's a generation of unbelief. They weren't fruitful. There was no growth that took place. It's really a sad testimony of the state of Israel during this time. And we see, as you begin to go through, God numbers each of the tribes, and we went through each of the numbers, and some of you said, man, yeah, that was really tedious, quite boring, actually. Let's just move ahead here. But as we went through and named each of these tribes and their numbers, you can compare it to the first census, and you can begin to see which tribes actually kind of grew, which tribes suffered the greatest kind of a loss. Now, you know, the tribe that suffered the greatest loss was Simeon. Their first count, they numbered 59,300. The second count, they counted 22,200. A difference of 37,100. A loss of 63%. Pretty huge. Do you remember this one in chapter 25? What was his name now? Zimri, yeah. Zimri was this one that brought this Moabite woman right before the camp, right before Moses, right before the tabernacle, and began to have this illicit relationship with her. And it says in verse 14 of chapter 25 that he was a leader of a father's house among the Simeonites. We begin to see somewhat of the condition of this tribe of Simeon, this tribe that suffered the greatest loss. Zimri, this one, that committed this gross indecency before the camp of Israel. And he was killed. But very possibly, again, a reflection of the tribe. And they suffered a great loss. Some of these tribes that were progressing with the Lord, they suffered a lot of growth. But nevertheless, we see each tribe counted, and the entire nation was one that decreased. to some degree. Now, look at verse 53 with me. Or verse 52, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to these the land shall be divided as an inheritance according to the number of names. To a large tribe you shall give a larger inheritance. To a small tribe you shall give a smaller inheritance. Each shall be given its inheritance according to those who are numbered of them. But the land shall be divided by lot. They shall inherit according to the names of the tribes of their fathers. According to the lot, their inheritance shall be divided between the larger and the smaller. So the larger tribes got the larger pieces of land, but the land choice was not theirs to make. They couldn't just go in and say, hey, I like this land. I'm going to put my stake in there. That's mine. There you go. No, each portion of land would be divided by lot, but the larger portions of land would go to the larger nations or the larger tribes, as God indicates here. And God's a God of order. He's got everything laid out for them. There's not going to be just a free-for-all, you know, like the pioneer kind of days. They just go in and we'll stake this land. And it wasn't a free-for-all. It was very decently done in order. Verse 57. And these are those who were numbered of the Levites, according to their families of Gershon, the families of the Gershonites of Kohath, the family of the Kohathites of Merari, the family of the Merarites. And these are the families of the Levites, the family of the Libnites, and so forth. Verse 59, the name of Amram's wife was Jochebed, the daughter of Levi, who was born of Levi in Egypt, and to Amram she bore Aaron and Moses and their sister Miriam. To Aaron were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. And Nadab and Abihu died when they offered profane fire before the Lord. And again, a reminder of their error and mistake. Now, those who were numbered of them were 23,000 every male from a month old and above. For they were not numbered among the other children of Israel, because there is no inheritance given to them among the children of Israel. So again, it shows here in verse 62 that there was no land inheritance for the Levites. They would be assigned now, when they went into the land, they'd be assigned 48 cities throughout the land to live in, but they would not own any portion of land themselves. Why was this so? Well, first of all, it fulfills Jacob's prophecy of Genesis chapter 49. In verse 7, he says, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel, speaking of the Levites. They would be scattered. Secondly, being spread out throughout the land, they would have greater influence and opportunity to teach the law and help people uphold it. They were God's representatives, representing God to the people and the people to God. And so being spread out, they'd have a greater influence throughout the nation as a whole. And number three, they would not inherit any land because God was to be their inheritance. Remember, it said that back in Numbers chapter 18, verse 20. They were privileged to serve God, and he was to be all that they needed. They had a great opportunity to be the ones that were camped closest to the tabernacle, working in the tabernacle, serving the Lord. And God says, listen, I'm going to be your inheritance. Everything you need, I'm going to take care of for you. And there would be a special relationship that would be done there through the Levites and with their God. Look at verse 63. And these are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar, the priest who numbered the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. But among these were not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. For the Lord had said to them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. So there was not left a man of them except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. Just as God said, every single person of that unbelieving generation would die out, and they did die out. And of the second census, no one was around from the first except two men, Joshua and Caleb. Why? Because these two were men of faith, and they will be the ones that will inherit this blessing. And they would be the ones that would be allowed entrance into the promised land, because they were ones that walked by faith and not by sight. When they went into the land to spy it out, they came back with a great report saying, surely the Lord will give us this land. And they were rewarded for it and blessed because of it. And they would be the only two from that first census allowed into the promised land. Well, then came the daughters of Zelophehad in chapter 27 here. The son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. And these were the names of his daughters. If any of you guys are right? Have children. You're looking for some girls' names. There's a few right here. Mala, Noah, Hogla, I like, Milka, and Tirzah. I mean, who needs those baby books? Just go to the Bible. Look at these things. These are rich, man. These are great. And so they stood now before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying this: Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Lord, in company with Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. This man just had daughters, five daughters. Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. Now, I like this. When the ladies here had a problem or concern, where did they go? It says that they went to the tabernacle where God's people were gathered. You know, that's such a good thing for us. When we're going through difficulties, when we have some issues, take it to the body of Christ and let the living Lord provide counsel to you through the body. Oftentimes, that's how he does it. So many times we're, oh man, I'm going through a difficult time and oh, I just don't want to go to church. I'm just not. Man, that's when you need to go. That's where you need to be when you are going through a hard time, when things are getting sour in your life. Come to the tabernacle as these ladies did. Come to church and let the body of Christ begin to encourage you and edify you and equip you and just bless you. Because the Lord wants to meet that need. And sure, he can do that at home. Sure, he can do that wherever you are. I'm not saying that that's, you know, he's only limited to operating here. But there's something to be said for just coming to where the people are gathered, as these ladies did. Now, these were women of faith. They were not in the land yet, but something interesting happens here and registers with them. They knew that they would be in that land and that that land would be divided to the families and tribes. And they were anticipating it. They weren't yet there, but they were realizing this and moving forward in faith, saying, listen, when we're in that land, you know, our father didn't have any sons. Who's this portion of land going to go to? And they were anticipating that with faith. They were women of faith. That'd be a great name for a ministry, Women of Faith. I think that's taken, isn't it? Yeah, okay. So, verse 5. Look what Moses does here. Moses brought their case before the Lord. You know, Moses, being the leader here, didn't try to say, well, all right, here's what you're going to do. All right, here's what I think you should do. He's not trying to act all like he's got it together, like he's got all the answers. He says, you know what, let me take this to the Lord. Boy, that's good counsel for us. When maybe people come to you with a problem, you don't need to be the one that kind of rattles off the answer right away and look all like, man, I know my stuff. I'm a smart man. Man, we can sit and say, you know what? Let's pray about that. Let's take that to the Lord. Let's see what he would have you do. And that's what Moses did. That's what we need to do. When people come to us with questions or concerns or different things, man, we can take it to the Lord and hear what the Lord's solution would be in the matter. And so the Lord spoke to Moses saying, the daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them. And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then he shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughter. You know, there are a lot of people in our world today that think this is a book that is all about, you know, men's rights. This book is a suppressor of women. Women submit to you know, that kind of stuff. Man, and people get all, you know, feathers ruffled and think, ah, I don't listen to that book, man. It's so outdated. Let me tell you something. God was on the side of the woman here. And surely we do see the woman's movement happening right here, back in Numbers. It's not a new thing that we're experiencing. It was happening right back here. Woman's right. The woman's movement here taking place. But God is a liberator of women. We see that in Jesus' life. We see that here in the book of Numbers. God was going to take care of them. And he's a God of equal opportunity. And he is in to women's rights. Galatians 3:28 says, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. It's interesting that where the gospel has made inroads into various places of the world, women have been liberated. But where communities and cultures have rejected the gospel, women are still being oppressed. Do the research. It's very interesting. You know, Barbara Walters did a story a number of years ago on gender roles in Kuwait before the Gulf War. And she was one that noted that women customarily walked about 10 feet behind their husbands. Well, Barbara Walters returned to do a follow-up story on this after the Gulf War. And she went out for a walk, and she noticed that this time the women were walking several yards in front of their husband now. Barbara Walters thought, this is incredible. This is great. This is marvelous. Can you tell the free world just what enabled women here to achieve this reversal of roles? And one Kuwaiti woman answered, landmines. But it's true, where the gospel has gone forth, women have been liberated, set on an equal plane, and God nevertheless is doing that here. And he goes on to say, in verse 9, if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then he shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him in his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, the Lord said to Moses, go up into this Mount Abraham and see the land which I have given to the children of Israel. And when you have seen it, you shall also shall be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was gathered. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to hallow me at the waters before their eyes. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So Moses now is given a glimpse of the what he's going to be missing out in the promised land. And it may kind of seem cruel, but God reminds Moses that it's because of his error at Meribah. Back in Numbers chapter 20, when God said, Moses, I want you to speak to the rock and water will come out and feed the people as they were complaining. And Moses got angry and he spoke to the people, got angry at them, and he struck the rock, ruining the type that it was to stand for. The rock was to be struck once because the rock spoke of Jesus. He would be afflicted, crucified once. But then after that, man, you just need to speak to him and that living water flows out. And so he ruined the type, misrepresented God, and it was a serious offense. But also, God has a wonderful picture to show Moses here. Because Moses represents the law. And you see, you cannot enter into that spiritual possession through the law. The law is not able to bring you into that spiritual possession. They needed Joshua, who is a type of Jesus. Same name, Joshua, Lord our salvation. It is only through Jesus Christ that we are able to enter into that spiritual possession and enjoy that abundant life that he gives us, that life in the Spirit. It's not through the law, but it comes through Jesus Christ, of which Joshua represents. And so he says there, you shall be gathered to your people. I like that. It wasn't just an end. But listen, Moses, you're going to be gathered to your people. I like that because death is not the end. Death is a beginning. Isn't that good? Death is a beginning where we're going to be gathered together with the Lord. Oh boy, it's going to be a good time. And let the Lord, or sorry, verse 15, then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation, who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, and that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. Boy, we begin to see now the heart of Moses. He doesn't complain and whine and argue and say, Lord, no, give me one more chance. I want to go in. I want to be there. Lord, have mercy. Give me one more chance. Doesn't argue, doesn't complain. What does he do? He begins to kind of intercede again for the people. He says, oh, Lord, in verse 17, who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in? that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. He was concerned for the sheep. He says, oh Lord, may there be somebody that can go in and lead them in and be as a shepherd to the sheep. This was the heart that Moses exemplified. And he had a true leader's heart here. Didn't complain, but cared for the people. Sheep need to be fed. They need to be cared for, and they need to be protected. And this is what Jesus does for us as our great shepherd, it says in John chapter 10. And this is what he wants pastors and leaders to do. This is what the word pastor means. It means shepherd. And our role as pastors is to feed the sheep, as we're doing right now, to care for the sheep, to lead them as God, the great shepherd, the good shepherd, leads us all. It's the same heart that God exemplified, that Jesus exemplified as he was out ministering. And he saw a great multitude, it says in Mark 6, verse 34, he saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. And so Jesus showed that same kind of heart. And there's other passages. Jesus commissioned Peter in the end of John to go and feed his lambs, to tend the sheep, and to feed the sheep. And Peter went on to elaborate on that in his epistle, 1 Peter 5, verse 2, where he says, shepherd the flock of God which is among you. Shepherd. Peter began to see that heart of Jesus, and he began to live that. Well, verse 18, and the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. And so now the Urim and the Thummim was this part of the priestly garment. And they were to have this Urim and Thummim, which means lights and perfection. So it's kind of a mystery what exactly this was, how it operated. Some believe it was like a white rock and a black rock. And they'd have a pouch. And when they went to inquire the Lord, they kind of have a yes or a no answer. And they'd reach in and grab out one of these rocks that represented either the yes or the no. And that was how they oftentimes would receive the Lord's will in a certain matter. And so many believe that's what the Urim and the Thummim was here. But nevertheless, Eleazar now, the son of Aaron, the high priest, would inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word, they shall go out, and at his word, they shall come in, and he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation. So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and he laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses. So Joshua now, he had been Moses' assistant now for these 40 years. He was faithful in what God had him to do. And now God gives him a greater responsibility and ministry. You know, we kind of talked about this already, but we might be those that want to achieve great things and climb that ladder of success. But God just wants us to be faithful with what he has for us at the time. Big or small? Publicly or privately? God is saying, listen, I have this task for you, this responsibility. Just be faithful in it. And when that time comes when he maybe gives you something greater, greater responsibility, you might even feel like, oh, I can't do that. There's no way I can do that. Oh, boy. Deuteronomy chapter 31 gives us some more details of this, you know, laying hands on a Joshua. You don't need to turn there. But Joshua might have thought, Lord, you're out of your mind. You want me to lead this people? I've been with them for 40 years. I know what kind of bunch they are. They're whiners, complainers. They're a bunch of babies. I don't want this. But Deuteronomy 31, verse 7 and 8. This is what it says. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him, in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. Do you hear that? The Lord, he is the one who goes before you, and he will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. Guys, that's a promise that we can hold on to. When the Lord begins to tap us on the shoulder and say, listen, here's what I want you to do. wait a second, Lord, that's out of my league. Wait a second. It's the Lord who will go before you, who will be with you, and he will guide you and strengthen you. Be strong and of good courage, for you're not alone. And I'm sure Joshua was able to keep going based on that. And it's something that we can take and go on. Chapters 28 and 29 deal with a review of the offerings. Now, we studied this in detail in previous studies. If you haven't been here when we did that, Leviticus chapter 23. We're going to breeze through this right now, chapters 28 and 29, because, again, we've handled it in detail. And it's just kind of a review. It's an important review, because as God is getting ready to bring his people into the promised land, listen, guys, you need to be people that are focusing on me and worshiping. This is what God is wanting his people to realize. I want you to be a people that are living a life of devotion, concentration, consecration unto me. And so they go through this review of the offerings. Now the Lord spoke to Moses saying, command the children of Israel and say to them, my offering, my food for my offerings made by fire is a sweet aroma to me. You shall be careful to offer to me at their appointed time. Notice what he's saying here. My offering, my food for my offerings. Do you understand this, guys? This is all the Lord's anyways. They weren't to bring something that was going to be like, oh God, I've really worked hard for this. I really don't want to depart with this because, you know, we've grown a time. The Lord's saying, listen, this is all mine to begin with. I'm just asking you to give back to me what I've already given to you. You know, when we carry that kind of thought, when we come and bring our offering to the Lord, whether it be an offering of money, whether it be an offering of our time, we can say, Lord, this isn't difficult because you've already given this to me. This isn't mine. This is yours, and I'm just giving it back to you. You've given me health in which I'm able to serve you, Lord. I'm just giving some time back to you. And that's something that we need to remember and realize. It's all the Lord's to begin with. And what we do give, we're just giving back to the Lord. And as we give, guess what's going to happen? The Lord will just give back. The Lord will bless, provide. He'll meet your needs. I'm not saying that we are people that give in order to get back. Never let that be the condition or the agenda there. We give simply because God's already given to us. And so you shall say to them in verse 3, this is the offering made by fire which you shall offer to the Lord, two male lambs in their first year without blemish, day by day as a regular burnt offering. The one lamb you shall offer in the morning and the other lamb you shall offer in the evening. And one-tenth of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering mixed with one-fourth of a hin of pressed oil. It is a regular burnt offering which was ordained at Mount Sinai for a sweet aroma, an offering made by fire to the Lord. And his drink offering shall be one-fourth of a hin for each lamb. In a holy place you shall pour out the drink of the Lord as an offering. The other lamb you shall offer in the evening as the morning grain offering and its drink offering. You shall offer it as an offering made by fire, sweet aroma to the Lord. You see this word repeated often in this chapter, sweet aroma to the Lord. You know, when we come and give our offering to the Lord, it's that sweet aroma to him. It's something that appeases him, pleases him. He's blessed through it. Not only are you going to be blessed through it, but he's blessed. He's like, oh, I love to see my children just coming and giving of themselves to me, giving of their resources perhaps to me. Oh, it's a sweet aroma to the Lord. But notice now, this is not dealing with, these chapters are not dealing with individual sacrifices and offerings. It's dealing with a nationalistic kind of an offering. Every day now, there were to be two lambs sacrificed, one in the morning, one in the evening. Boy, that's kind of a good kind of guideline for us, isn't it? When we wake up, Lord, here's my life. Just give it to you. Thank you for this day. And as the psalmist said, but to you I've cried out, O Lord, and in the morning my prayer comes before you. But then again in the evening, oh, maybe as we put our head on our pillow, Lord, thank you for this day. Thank you for all you've given me. And Lord, would you just take all these things that perhaps I've done and may you just bless it and use it for your glory? Psalm 141 verse 2 says, let my prayer be set before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. Morning and evening, starting our day, ending our day, with just focus on the Lord. Offering, sacrifice unto him. We're told to be those that are just that living sacrifice. Romans chapter 12, verse 1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. We're to be those that are living in a constant awareness of, my life is just a living sacrifice unto the Lord. It's His. God, every chance I get, let me give that back to you. Well, and then on the Sabbath days now, they were to offer two lambs in their first year without blemish and 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour as a grain offering mixed with oil with its drink offering. This is the burnt offering for every Sabbath besides the regular burnt offering with its drink offering. So they were to offer another two lambs now on each of the Sabbaths. So we see the offerings increase. Now, they were to also offer sacrifices at the beginning of their months. It says in verse 11, the beginning of your months, you shall present a burnt offering to the Lord. Now, this is what they were to give: two young bulls, one ram, seven lambs in their first year without blemish. So for the beginning of each month, the sacrifice increased to two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs. Oftentimes in the Bible, when you read of new moon festivals and that sort of a thing, it's referring to this month because it's based on a lunar kind of calendar rotation. So the beginning of their months was the new moon festival. Now, look at verse 16. On the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. And on the 15th day of this month is the feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. And you shall present an offering made by fire as a burnt offering to the Lord. Two young bulls, one ram, and seven lambs in the first year. Be sure they are without blemish. So the Passover now, this was to be celebrated on the 14th day, the first of their first month. Passover, of course, points to the ultimate sacrifice, Jesus Christ, our Passover lamb. John saying, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. So Jesus came. And when was Jesus crucified? On the Passover, fulfilling this feast, the celebration perfectly. Jesus comes as our Passover lamb, crucified on the Passover. And the Passover was, of course, to commemorate what God did for them back in Egypt when He delivered them out of Egypt, as God spared them, as they would put the blood of the lamb upon the doorposts in even that shape of a cross. And God delivered them out. And we understand that we are delivered from our sin and bondage through Jesus Christ, who put His life on the cross and died for us. And then that was followed by the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that was the very next day for the next week. They were to clear out all the leaven in their house. What is leaven? A picture of sin. And it took Jesus Christ, a life that had no sin, to be that perfect sacrifice for us. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, for He made Him who knew no sin to be sin for us, that we might become the righteousness of God in Him. So the Feast of Passover and then the Feast of Unleavened Bread. What comes next? It's the Feast of Weeks, or otherwise called the Feast of Pentecost. Look at verse 26. Also, on the day of the first fruits, when you bring a new grain offering to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work. You shall present a burnt offering as a sweet aroma to the Lord, two young bulls, one ram, and seven lambs in their first year. Now remember, this is, again, on top of the two lambs that were to be sacrificed every day in the tabernacle by the priests. These priests were busy people. You know what I'm saying? This wasn't kind of some laid-back job where they would go golfing all the time like, you know, pastors do, that sort of thing. But they were busy. You know, they were keeping going here. Not only did Jesus die on a cross, but He rose again. You see, this Feast of First Fruits, as it's sometimes called, Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, or Feast of First Fruits, this took place on the day after the Passover Sabbath, on the beginning of the week. When did Jesus rise again? The beginning of the week, after the Sabbath Passover, or the Passover Sabbath. And Jesus, we're looking at this in a somewhat of a prophetic nature here today. There's a lot of things that we can be addressing, but like I say, we've already addressed it. Go online, listen to Leviticus 23, or study through that, or pick up a CD if we have one back here, and you can know more in depth about these feasts, because we're just breezing through them today. But we're looking at them in a bit of a prophetic nature today. But the Feast of Pentecost was fulfilled, again, as Jesus rose again, bringing life to us, that hope of life that we have. It speaks of the day Jesus rose. But then also, listen to what 1 Corinthians 15:20 says. But now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. He's become that hope for those that have died because he's bringing life. Because not only did he die on a cross, but he rose again. And he breathed life into the church when on Pentecost. That's when the birth of the church happened. And the disciples and all those that were gathered there in the upper room were breathed life into them as the Holy Spirit filled them on Pentecost. And they went out and they began to spread the word of the good news. Well, so not only do we see Jesus dying on a cross, this sinless, perfect sacrifice, but we see him rise again, filling the church, commissioning the church. Now, what comes next in our prophetic calendar? Well, look at what feast comes next. Verse chapter 29. And in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work for you. It is a day of blowing the trumpets. Oh, I like that. It's a feast of trumpets, Rosh Hashanah. It's a Jewish New Year. Feast of trumpets, prophetically, I believe, is when Jesus is going to rapture up the church. Speaking of the rapture, Pentecost spoke of the start of the church. Trumpets speak of the gathering of the church. When 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 16 says that the trumpet of God shall sound and we'll be caught up and meet him in the clouds, speaks of the rapture of the church. And we see this great order taking place even through the feasts that were to be followed here. And on the Feast of Trumpets, you shall offer, in verse 2, a burnt offering is a sweet aroma to the Lord, one young bull, one ram, and seven lambs in their first year without blemish. Look at verse 7. On the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall afflict your souls. You shall not do any work. You shall present a burnt offering to the Lord as a sweet aroma, one young bull, one ram, and seven lambs in their first year. Be sure they are without blemish. So this is the Feast of Atonement, or the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. It's the only day that the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies. And he'd come with that sacrifice and sprinkling the blood upon the mercy seat. It was a time of affliction. It says here, you shall afflict your souls. It was a day where they would think about their past year and all the things that they've done, and kind of in confession, just bring forth all their things that they've done. But then also remembering all the good things that they've done. But it was a day of affliction. And prophetically, I believe it speaks of a time, a period for Israel when there will be great affliction. What have we seen so far? Jesus on the cross, the sinless, perfect sacrifice, him rising again, filling the church, rapturing the church. What comes after the church is raptured? The tribulation. You see, it'll be during the tribulation, this seven-year period, when the nation of Israel will be greatly afflicted. You think they're afflicted now? You think the nations are conspiring against them now? Wait till the tribulation and you will see it in even greater. Well, let's hope we don't see it because we're not going to be here. But the world will see Israel sought after even with great fervor and just real anger. And they will be afflicted at the hands of the Antichrist. Well, then what do? We move into verse 12. On the 15th day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work, and you shall keep a feast to the Lord 7 days. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering made by fire as a sweet aroma to the Lord. 13 young bulls, 2 rams, and 14 lambs in their first year. They shall be without blemish. So here now is the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Booths. This was the most celebratory of feasts. This was the day that they would come together and they would spend their week in these little lean-to shelters as a way of remembering God's provision for them in the wilderness. He's brought them out of Egypt. He's led them through the wilderness, provided for them. Manna came down. Water from rocks came and they were fed. Their thirst was quenched. God took care of them. Eventually led them into the promised land. But the Feast of, of tabernacles or booths commemorated this time that their forefathers spent in the wilderness, God's provision, God's faithfulness to them. It was the most celebratory of feasts. Well, what's going to happen after the tribulation? Again, it's going to climax. The nations are going to come against Israel. And what's going to happen? Jesus is going to come again, his second coming, with us at his side. You looking forward to that? Wow, that's going to be incredible. I'm going to have my video camera going, I think. I want to film that because it's going to be awesome, you know. And we're going to come with him at his side. And he's going to come down and he's going to bring an end to the nations that are coming against Israel, the Battle of Armageddon. And he's going to usher in his millennial reign. See, we're going to spend 7 years in heaven, but then we're going to come back to the earth and we're going to spend 1,000 years. I tell you, people that think eternity is going to be, that's going to be boring. We're just going to sit on clouds with harps and that's all we're going to do. Like they think, man, it's going to be exciting. Eternity, wow. But 1,000-year reign with Christ, and you see, it's going to be in this period where Israel is going to see their Messiah, their salvation, and they're going to turn to the Lord Jesus as their Messiah, and they're going to be saved, and they're going to be allowed to come into this millennial reign in a different way than we are, but nevertheless, they're going to be there, and they're going to experience this peace of God. They're going to experience his safety, his provision, and they're going to experience his faithfulness. And it says that they're even going to continue to follow this feast during the millennium. Zechariah chapter 14 tells us that. But we see this prophetic timetable begin to unfold. And the sacrifice continues through this feast each day, and it drops in number each day. As you continue on and read through that chapter, because it just goes on to continue to say, on the sixth day they'd bring this, on the fifth day they'd bring that. And you don't want me to read through all that, so you get the idea. But verse 39, these you shall present to the Lord at your appointed feast, besides your vowed offerings and your freewill offerings, as your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, as your drink offerings and your peace offerings. So Moses told the children of Israel everything, just as the Lord commanded Moses. For Israel to obey what God has commanded in Numbers 28 and 29, it would mean that every year the priests would sacrifice on behalf of the nation 1,086 lambs, 113 bulls, 32 rams, more than a ton of flour, and some 1,000 bottles of oil and wine. The Lord wanted to show his people what the priority was to be. It was to be a continual giving to the Lord, a regular time of worship, devotion, and sacrifice to him. And you see, if we ourselves are not regular in these things, if we're not continuing on in these things, if we cease to be regular in our time of devotion, we are going to find ourselves becoming very irregular. We're going to find ourselves getting out of balance. We're going to find ourselves missing on certain points and just not quite together. God says, listen, I want you to be those that are coming and just spending time with me in devotion, in offering, living as a sacrifice to me. Because as you do, it's putting the priority on him. It's keeping us focused upon him. And we'll find our life to be in just a flow with his will, with his word, that we can quickly get out of sync over if we are not following with what he shows us here in his word. It was vital for the nation if they were to remain strong and fruitful. And so it is vital for us if we too want to be strong and fruitful in our walk with the Lord. Guys, we went through this quickly, and I'm sorry that we've gone a little longer today as we normally do. But again, if you want to know more about these feasts, because there's some fascinating, great things that we can talk about, and we already have in previous studies. So if you haven't been here, check out Leviticus 23, whether it be online on our site or elsewhere. But some great studies there. And again, just kind of neat to go through these and see the sort of prophetic look at these feasts and how it pertains to us today and what the Lord has done. Because the Lord is the fulfillment of all these things. Jesus has fulfilled these in his life. And it's so incredible and wonderful to see. Well, let's close in prayer.